You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Welcome to the 28 of the Doolanders.
Hey, Nick, how are you?
Good, Blake. You know why?
Why?
Because we're on summer camp.
We are on the Doolanders summer camp, and we have got some helpers here with us today.
We sure do. We actually have a live audience.
We do. Hey, guys, how has the Doolanders summer camp been? Yeah, that's what happens when your wives leave you with the kids.
Yeah. At least it's warm.
It is warm. Well, the great thing for us is we're sort of off duty, aren't we? Because the kids are actually going to intro.
They are.
This week's guest.
And did all the work for us.
Who is?
You mean the kids or the guest?
The guest.
The guest is Declan Fay.
You're the kids.
Hi, Blake.
Hey, Ronnie. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for joining us on the Doolanders camp here down on the Mornington Peninsula. How's your day been?
Very good.
What's been the best bit?
Going to the beach.
It was super cool down there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, me and your dad spoke to Declan Fay prior to Christmas. Can you tell us a little bit about Declan Fay?
Well, he was a very cool cello player.
He was a super cool cello player. He had the choice between being a super cool drummer and a super cool cello player, and he chose the cello. Do you love the cello?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Hey, what are we going to do tomorrow down here?
Probably go to the beach again.
Sounds good. You looking forward to listening to Declan?
Yep.
Love it. Thanks, Ronnie.
Bye.
Hey, Ruben, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I am fantastic. How's your day been?
It's been well.
What's been the best part of your day?
Going to the beach.
Are you really looking forward to hearing Declan Fay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, tell me, what happened when Declan Fay's grandma rang him about something to do with uni?
Well, Declan's grandmother called him on the phone and she said, if you're not going to go to uni, you're going to have to go to war.
So to make him go to uni, she rang him and said, Declan, if you don't go to uni, you'll have to go to war.
Yep.
Wow. That's a good reason to go to uni.
Sure is.
Thanks, Rubes.
No problem.
Hey, Miller, how are you?
I'm good, Dad. How are you?
I am very well. Hey, how are you having fun down here at the Doolanders summer camp?
Yeah, been surfing some waves and waving some plays. Yeah.
What's waving some plays?
I don't know.
Just made that up.
Yeah.
Hey, we are really excited to listen to this next podcast about Declan Fay. Tell us a little bit about Declan Fay.
So he writes skits and stuff. He's a very famous comedy writer. He wrote for Rove.
Yeah.
Ronnie Chang's international student. Great for
show.
Netflix.
Fantastic
and
show.
And Crossbred.
What is Crossbred?
It's a award-winning podcast.
Is it better than this podcast?
So are we talking ratings-wise or are we talking about quality-wise?
Give us a break, Miller. What? Just support us. Say yes.
All right, then fine. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Hey, mate, thank you so much. What are you looking forward to tomorrow?
Cake.
Cake.
Yeah.
Not sure that's on the menu. But
oh, it is now.
Here's Declan Fay.
Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say, do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Tweetus Plum, I think you're a microphone connoisseur, aren't you? You're about
to pick him up. A budget, that's very funny. A budget microphone connoisseur.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Good one. I'm good.
Also, we actually have a question. What is the equivalent of a clapperboard for podcasts?
A clap.
Just a clap.
It's a clap. When you do you ever do that if you do remotely, that you do a clap?
No.
It's one of the best ways to match up you to the other person. If you've got them on a speaker, either coming out of your computer or on a phone, you get them to clap and it goes in their end and it goes out your end. And it's kind of the sound wave is wide enough that you can match it perfectly. So if you get them to do two claps, it kind of works like a clapperboard.
That would have been good to know 10 months ago.
Some people do the countdown. They go 5, 4, 3. They get you both count so they can match it up.
Oh, yeah.
And that seems to work okay, but we're just stuck with the clap.
Oh,
That's just terrible. If you cut that out of context, that would appear terrible. Clap. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it.
All right, we're ready to go. 3, 2, 1. Everyone clap together.
I don't think you need to do it if you're in the same room. I think it's.
That's true. Well, welcome to the Doolanders, Declan. How are you, mate?
I'm good. I've got to say, as someone who has podcasted for a long time, if you've watched me looking around at all your stuff, it's not because I want to steal it.
Yeah.
Your setup is amazing. The microphones are excellent.
Yep.
Your desk is excellent. Yeah. It's usually somebody's got a bunch of old microphones plugged into a Zoom that's running out of batteries.
Yeah.
It looks like you didn't just build this extra annex on your house for podcasting.
Well, we did, but the problem is that we've got great equipment, but the hosts are shit. So anyway, we'll see how this one falls out.
They used to say that. I remember when we started doing comedy 20 years ago, and I remember the guy saying, you should make a really good, you should spend a lot of money on your poster because then that will put a pressure on you to be as good as the picture that's on your poster. And I don't know if we ever matched up to that quality, but at least it gives you something to aim for.
Well, we didn't go poster. We went beer coaster. And as you can see, we've got a few coasters floating around. I don't know whether we'll ever live up to the standard of those beer coasters or not.
Well, it's often they say it's good. I actually really like that you had a beer coaster. Do you always have scribbles on the back?
Generally, yeah.
They kind of look like the scribbles of Russell Crowe from A Beautiful Mind or something. It's just random numbers on the...
But you got to decode it.
It's the classic, Australian thing that they often go, we came up with this idea in a pub and we wrote it on the back of a beer coaster.
Yeah.
But then I always wonder if that was true. It's too much of an easy, nobody's writing things down in pubs. It's just kind of, it's often a madman's scrawl or something.
Talking about writing things. Mm. Declan, tell the Doolanders, our listeners, what do you do?
What do I do? It's always a dangerous thing to tell people you're a comedy writer because they go I will say something funny or write something funny.
Can you write something funny on the back of a
on the back of a coaster? When we finish, I'll try to think of something amusing to write. It's a weird thing that can often set off alpha males. Fucking funny are you, mate? It's this weird or it goes the other way where they go, I've got something funny. And they'll often do it I might give comedy a go. And you don't, it's very hard to explain them. It is a extremely difficult, especially stand-up comedy. I think people think, and I'm saying this as someone that was never a very good stand-up comedian, and it's partly why I stopped doing it, because it is, I think, one of the most difficult things that you can do. You have to stand up in a room of people that have never met you on your own with no one backing you up, no bells or whistles, and you have to hope that something that you think in your mind is funny, that you've put it into the right order of words, that then someone in the audience will think it's funny. And it is... I admire anybody that can do that and can then keep doing it, because you have to fail more than you win at it. The only way you get better is to just keep failing and keep working out what doesn't work. So you hope that you land on what does work. So yeah, I would say a comedy writer, but sort of just generally a writer. That's basically what I do. Whatever I do has some element of writing in it.
Cool. So we'll come to the process of writing, and actually before we got to the you arriving today and having a look at your background and what you've done, I was thinking that just the pressure around how do you write funny stuff all the time, but you can take us through how you do just that. So where did it all begin for Declan Fay? Where'd you grow up? Where were you born?
I always hate saying that. I was born in North Baldwin.
Mm. Why do you hate saying that?
Well, I always feel like there's not much going on in North Baldwin. Yeah. When I was about six, we moved to Perth for about 3 years. And then when I was 9 or 10, my dad, I think I told you this when we weren't on air, my dad won a quadrilla, which seemed like a really great thing at the time when he came home and had a bunch of money in his hands and like the blocks of like old paper notes, like 20s and 50s. Oh, and wow. I don't think I'd ever seen a $100 note until that day. Like I was kind of fascinated by it. It's like this mysterious object. And he then decided to use that money to buy an ice cream shop on Flinders Street Station. I've still never quite, there was to that point, there was not like it was some secret thing of his that he loved making ice cream, or he was sneaking out to the backyard to make ice creams in the middle of the night. There was no, I don't know what, if he was still alive, I would ask him what the leap was. Yeah. I don't know why he went, I'll go from being a journalist who in Perth, he was the head of ABC radio in what? Perth. I don't know what the step was to go, I'll go and run an ice cream shop in Melbourne.
That is a fascinating leap, isn't it? Yeah.
I think I've thought about it a few times. I think that he liked people. I think he liked making people happy, and I think he wanted to run his own business. Yeah. And somehow, all of that kind of melded into, oh, I'll run an ice cream shop. But anyone will tell you that moving to Melbourne to start an ice cream shop is not the, like, we were in Perth. Surely that would be a better place to have an ice cream shop than Melbourne.
Before that, you actually broke onto the scene at the age of one and had your first TV appearance. Apparently you nailed it too.
I played a fat baby in the long-running Australian television show Prisoner.
Yep.
I was in it for maybe about like 10 episodes or so, and then I've got the DVD. I found, I worked out what, I knew what the, mum, it was an assiduous diary keeper, and so she worked out the dates, and I was able to work out from going to IMDb what number the episodes were, and when DVDs came in, they released the entire box set of Prisoner DVDs, and I didn't buy that. I waited till like then they broke the box set up, and I was able to buy online the DVD that I was in. And so I think it was about 10 episodes, and then I was then replaced by another baby.
Were you credited as fat baby?
No, but I'm not being facetious when I say that. I was a pretty large child, and maybe that's why, you know, I mean, the entertainment industry is very fickle about people's appearance and weight, and maybe they just kind of went, we've got to get it. Big. We need a more streamlined baby in here. This fat baby's not tracking well with the audience demographics.
Can you pull back the milk supply a little?
Yeah, that's, imagine they were saying to my mum, look, could you just feed him a bit less before he goes on? They were probably getting the minute by minutes back, and then every minute it kind of cut to me. They were realising people are just tuning out in their droves. Yeah. So, yeah, I was replaced by a far more svelte baby.
So you've come back to Melbourne after the sojourn in Perth. Mm-hmm. Old man's nailed the quaddie. I can't believe he's nailed the quaddie and gone on become an ice cream shop owner.
Ice creamery.
As a kid,
yeah,
swanning around North Baldwin,
yeah.
What did you want to do?
I didn't. I never knew when people asked me. It's funny. You look back at what you were doing. Mum moved house a couple of years ago and she just had boxes of all our stuff.
Yeah.
And most of the things that I did were writing. Like you would see, like, you know, lots of kids draw, and like my kids draw all sorts of pictures, but I always wrote. So I think I was doing it without realizing that's kind of where my life would go. I think while I was at school, I kind of thought like music for a while. I had played like the two strangest instruments you could play at the same time, which were cello and drums. And
wow.
Yeah, I just liked both.
One foot in each camp.
Well, the cello, they made you play an instrument at school. Yeah. And I think I think I got the cello just because I was quite big, so you could carry it to and from school. I think that was the only reason they thought we'll give it to this kid. Or maybe that if you play a string instrument, you can attract bullies. Maybe that's big enough to repel them. But then I started to see that music was like you had far more chance of like meeting girls or being popular if you played in a band. Yeah. And so I started to learn the drums, and I preferred that.
How was your ability on the skins?
It was okay. It was. I think the thing is, like, when you play, it's hard to play a string instrument and be good at it straight away. Any instrument really.
Yeah.
But string instruments at the start are awful. Like you can't play them in tune. They're always going out of tune. They don't. It's hard to sound any, like, you know, if you give a kid a guitar, you can at least teach them like one chord and it sounds okay. And I think with drums, there was something for a kid's brain, like so immediate that you could sit down and kind of go do, 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 and you're already making a noise.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that.
Were you a sports person, a sportsman, you like AFL, Aussie rules? I think your old man wanted you to don a.
He did. Yeah. He did. He had come very close to playing footy growing up. South Melbourne before they were Sydney Swans. And I'm led to believe he was just a bit small for playing. Like, he was quite short, like maybe 170 centimetres. And this is before they talked about in and under players. And he just didn't quite make it. And I think, that classic thing where your dad then goes, I want – and then I was very – big kid, and I think he thought, oh, he's got what I didn't have, which is size, but I didn't have the other things that he had, like ability to kick straight or I could mark because I was bigger than everybody else, but I just couldn't. It wasn't like I was a kid that almost made it, like I was so far from making it. There was an element of delusion there from him. Like, I wasn't like I, almost made some state team or something. Like, I was a long way off.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then there was this turning point around about, I don't know, you're 14 or 15, and our school had a musical, and the musical landed on the same night as football training.
Mm.
And so I kind of had to make a choice. And if you – that was the easiest way for the football team to cut you. If you weren't going to football training, then they would cut you. If you were playing in the musical, they didn't see that as any valid excuse. Like, they – and so that was – I think I'd already made the choice for myself where I was drifting. And I remember just thinking, like, it's actually where the rehearsal room was at our school, was a function room, and you could look out the window and see the guys playing football.
Yeah.
And it was just very clear to me, like, why would I want to be out there in the rain, not playing very well, and trying to sort of keep up with these guys when you could be in here? And because we're a boys' school, there's suddenly girls in the musical with you. We're making stuff. We're laughing. Like, it was just, to me, it was a no-brainer. But that doesn't mean that's a better thing to do. Like, I'm sure there's some kids that much prefer being on the footy oval. But I was like, oh, yeah, this is where I want to be. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. What was your role in that musical,
I do. The first school musical was Guys and Dolls.
Wow.
And the role that I got, again, I think it was purely size-based, this choice. I got into the mission band and I was playing the tuba. So you had to, but it was like fake tuba playing, like someone in the orchestra is playing it and you're kind of playing along to it. And I was kind of annoyed because all the other people that got into the chorus, like friends of mine and stuff, everyone else in that show is like gangsters. So they're all walking around in three-piece suits going, hey, it's Guys and Dolls. Whereas we're in this like mission band in actual Salvation Army uniforms. And we had to march, and I could never march in time to the point that I still remember like walking out on the stage and this – he was an okay guy, but he had a terrible temper. The conductor yelled out, like in the rehearsal when we're in the theatre, Declan Fay, if you can't fucking march in time, I will come up there and I will rip you off the stage. This is when you were allowed to, as a teacher, swear and abuse kids. Yeah. And I – I don't think that's a particularly good way to behave towards students, and I wouldn't do that. But I wouldn't do that now. But I remember thinking like, oh God, I wish I got to be one of the gangsters. But
he's good at the accent.
Yeah, well, that it's kind of like everybody. The kids all adopt like this one version of a Brooklyn, like, hey! I was in the Mission Band, unfortunately, but that was the kind of beginning of it. Like, even just having that small role, like, I really, really liked it. It wasn't even so much about being on the stage. Like, I just liked that we were making something and that you all make it as a team, and then I kind of like that you start in this tiny rehearsal room and then suddenly it appears on stage. There was something kind of magical about that. And again, I don't think I went, oh, I'll do this. I think in my mind though, I liked all the like, it's weird. Like if I remember that first musical, I don't remember many nights of being on stage, but I remember like, I loved all the like little like hallways behind the stage and the wings. And so I think even then my brain was like going, oh, I like this, but I like being kind of in the shadows or something.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you've a little spark's gone off and you're like, yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
So as you wandered through high school, you finished high school. Did you go to uni? Did you like think, okay, this is the path I'm leading to?
Well, I did. I finished school. I still didn't know what I wanted to be. I did quite honestly think that I would, at that stage, I knew I wanted to do something creative. I thought I was going to be a musician. I thought I was going to be a cello player.
A cello, not the drummer.
No, somebody had said to me, like, cello suddenly became very suddenly cool in the 90s because you may not remember this. Well, at least in my mind. Right. Well, right. If you think about it, there was always those MTV Unplugs like Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and they a lot of them often had a cellist.
Yeah,
and it went from being this outcast, at least in my mind, I was like, oh, my God, they've got a cello in it. And I think I was kind of encouraged by people like, oh, there's not many good cello players. And so in my mind, I was like, oh, maybe I'll do that. But I don't know if I actually loved it. I think I just liked that it was this creative thing. And so then I finished school, and then I didn't get into any of the music schools and just decided to take the one course I got into was arts at Melbourne Uni, and I took a year off because I was like, I actually don't know what I want to do here. I was pretty burnt out from school, and so I deferred for the year. Much to my dad was really worried because he didn't go back to uni he didn't go to uni when he was younger, and that kind of worried him. And then my grandmother got this real bee in her bonnet because for Irish people it's all about like education and like your kids having a better life than you. And she kept like ringing up going, oh, I hate doing her accent, but she'd go, I think you should go to uni. I think you've made a mistake. You should go to uni. And then she'd get like weird about it. And I remember she took me out shopping and I could buy anything that I wanted in Maya. And she kept going, maybe you should get this jacket for uni. Get this jacket. And I was like, you don't need a jacket just for uni. Like, and then what was her last ditch attempt? It was 98, and maybe that was – maybe there was the – I think there was like a coup in Indonesia during that year. Yeah. And she said I'm not going to do her accent, but she said she rang up. She said, I've just been listening to the radio. There's a very good chance Australia is going to have to go to war in Southeast Asia. Yeah. And the first people they're going to choose are people that have deferred. I swear to God. I swear. Like, and I knew she was lying. Like, because I liked the news and I had watched the news. And I was like, I knew she was lying. And imagine that. The first people they chose are people that have deferred. That's ludicrous. Like, because most people that defer, you don't eat well in that year. You kind of, there was a lot of drinking and experimenting with substances. That would be the single worst people you could send into a war zone.
Yeah, well, my old man got scripted to Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
Didn't go because he'd been on a 5-day bender of just drinking piss every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Walks up to the medical. No, sorry, sir, you don't make it. High blood pressure.
Wow.
Just from being on the piss for 5 days. Anyway, back to your grandmother. Wise words from your grandmother. Yeah. And so you've heeded her warning.
No, I fully ignored her warning and took the year off. And and I just did whatever jobs came up for that year. And
What were some of the ripping jobs that you...
I did lots of stuff. I worked for a catering company, doing like catering for like corporate events. I worked for a ticketing company where you would ticket for like events, like for like you'd an order would come in for tickets. And literally what we would do is count, like, you know, the lanyards that hang around your neck and the plastic things. You would count those into groups of four. And that is seriously all we did for like all for maybe 3 weeks. You just go, oh, they made an order. There's four of those because it was 4 days of the Grand Prix.
Were you any good at that? Or?
I was pretty. I reckon I managed to count to four more times than I didn't. Occasionally, you get a complaint going, "There's only three here," or "There's." So I did that. I worked. What else did I do in that year? I worked at a casting company. And so I would see, but I was just on the camera, so I would see actors come in and I just like film it. What else did I do? Worked at school, at like kids' camps. So you'd go and just help out on camps. They had asked me to go to the camps. I was being employed by them. I didn't just turn up to kids' camps. But I did that. So, but I remember thinking at the end of the year, like, I think it was a good thing to do because I hadn't just like stumbled into uni. I then went, okay, I want to go back. As much as it was good to have money, I want to go back and kind of enjoy this time, work out what I'm supposed to do, because none of these things is sort of what I want to do.
And what did you work out that you were supposed to do?
Well, I still didn't work it out. Like, I went and did arts at Melbourne Uni and I liked it, but anyone that did, either of you guys do arts degrees?
I did half an arts degree, yeah.
I was going to say, your house is way too big to have done an arts degree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I did an arts degree and I thought I was studying drama at Rudston at the time.
Yeah.
And
I thought, where Guys and Dolls was, at Rudston.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe what year?
1994.
I reckon that might have been, I'd left by then. And I got halfway through an arts degree and I thought, you know, I'm going to go and become famous as an actor.
Yeah.
Clearly it didn't happen. Anyway.
It's a hard, well, that's what I learned from standing on the camera. Like, it is, you'd want to love acting. Like, it is an excruciatingly, at the time they would do, this company had some contract to do all the American pilots, and they had some very early internet technology that you could film it and then they would send the films to America, which sounds easy now, but at the time you had to make these big FTP files. And so you would literally do 30 days in a row and you would see the same actors, and they were invariably, most of them, really good. But it's just, and like, especially for women where it was so appearance based, you'd see the same woman come in with her hair a different way for each character for 30 days. And I just thought, this is really, you would have to love this to do it. And I don't love this enough to want to do something like that.
Yeah.
Did you recognize anyone years later and go, I reckon you came through?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The big one was, you know, so this woman came in and did a monologue for an American movie, and she was an Australian woman, but she had to do the monologue in like a kind of like Eastern European, I'll say like Polish kind of, I feel like it was like a movie about World War II, and it was like page and a half monologue, smashed it out of the park. She was the best, she was an older woman, she's about 55, 60, smashed it out of the park. And we sent it to the producer in the States, and the producer just goes, nah, she's too old. No one knows who she is. And she was the best by a mile. And she turned out to be the woman that ended up playing the mum in Please Like Me, Deborah Lawrence. And I remember the producer saying at the time, no, not the producer, the casting woman who ran the thing. She said, I really feel for someone like Deborah Lawrence. She's one of the best actors I've ever met, but there's not that many roles for older women in Australia, and the one place there is the States, and they don't want to take a person they haven't heard of. And so years later, when I saw her in Please Like Me, I was like, oh, that is a real victory that you got to do that. And I kind of admired, like, what was that, 15, 20 years later or something?
State, so, of course.
She did. So, yeah, there was quite a few during that time. I was just, I'm trying to think who else. Angus Sampson, I remember, who's now ended up in Fargo.
Yeah.
I think the ones I remember is the very people that were very distinct characters and kind of they did something interesting or some more will come to me as I I'm trying to think now. Somebody quite famous will jump into my mind later in the interview when it's completely irrelevant, but there was quite a few at the time.
Okay,
so you're wandering through your arts degree. Mm-hmm. Was there a point in time that you Did you create a comedy show?
Close. Yeah. I remember getting very frustrated halfway through that year and thinking, there seems to be all this energy here, but I don't know how to tap into it. And then it might have been at like lunchtime or something. I saw like a group on the stage in the sort of main like courtyard area doing comedy sketches. And I remember thinking like, I remember kind of being a bit mesmerized by it, that they were just doing comedy and like they were, it was kind of crazy. Even if I explained what they were doing now, it wouldn't seem that funny, but yeah. To me there was just something kind of really interesting about it. And I remember waiting and I picked the kind of nicest person out of them, and it was a girl in the group, and I said, how did you get into this? And she said, we were all in the Melbourne Uni Law Review last year. And she said they audition it each year. And she said, I remember her saying, she said they were always looking for performers and for writers. And I remember thinking, maybe, I don't know if I'd be confident to like get up and do that in front of everyone, but maybe the writing thing. And she said, I think they're auditioning it in the next couple of weeks. And so I went to the audition. I was absolutely terrified. And I got in. There was 11 people in that group, and I was the 11th person on the list. And I remember thinking, like, you know, you're very paranoid, that imposter syndrome. I remember thinking, there's no way they think that I'm funny. They've just put me in because they feel sorry for me. But I got in, and that was the beginning of it kind of changing. I thought, even then, it wasn't like this is a career. I just thought, this is what I like. I just like doing this now. And you'd meet in these tiny rooms and just someone would have a dumb idea about, hey, what about if we did X?
Yeah.
And you'd try to do it and then you'd write it down. And it would just, I kind of really liked that. There was an immediacy to it that you could come up with an idea and then suddenly you'd written a script. Like, I kind of liked that. And then the real tipping point, one of the guys in that show, his name was Chris Kennett, and he was doing a show on Triple R, and he said, because I talked a lot, and he said, do you want to come in one night and come on the radio? And as soon as we did that, I realized if I stood in front of people and saw them looking, I was very self-conscious. But as soon as we did the radio, it was like no one was looking. You were in this kind of sealed off booth, and I kind of just felt a bit like I could do this. Like, I kind of like not being looked at when I'm trying to be funny. That's really what it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And you're on Triple R for how long?
So we started, he was doing a show in the middle of the night that was called Unexplained Phenomena, and it was a show about like, well, we used to call it like a cult show about like, you know, it was meant to be about ghosts and like paranormal activity. That's what it was about. But really it was just a lot of stoned people ringing up in the middle of the night discussing their hallucinations. But I still really... And then I realised that part of the reason he got me in is that I liked answering the phone to them. Part of it was that people were supposed to call in and I didn't mind answering it, whereas he didn't overly like talking to them. And so I would talk to them and then we'd put them to air. And it's just funny. It's kind of what you look forward to, isn't it? Like as soon as one was finished, it was midnight and it would finish at 2 and I'd get home at like 2:33 and then I'd have to get up the next day to go to uni, but I didn't care because it was like, that's the thing. Yeah, and then as soon as it was finished, I would look forward to it for the next week, and I think that's where I started to go, hang on, I think this is what I like doing.
Nice one.
Yeah.
How many listeners did tune into the...
We used to always say it was a cult show, which basically means we don't know how many people are listening. Right. It might not be that many. But I do think that before like podcasts and before people had other media, like you would get, you know, you would get a lot of phone calls and kids from the suburbs and you were kind of keeping them company. And so I'd say I feel like it was quite a few thousand, because if we then started to put on shows for like the comedy festival and stuff, or just like small shows, and we would often fill up audiences, and I think it was people listening to us in the middle of the night, because you kind of become like a weird friend for them or something. Bit like what podcasts are now, like it's a kind of intimate form of listening. People listen to them before they go to bed or on the tram or wherever. So I think the audience wasn't – I think it was actually a fairly decent audience.
Yeah, nice one. So you completed your arts degree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then where did you wander? What did you wander into?
Well, that was where it kind of – it was just – I think it was the last year of uni and we decided – we'd just been doing shows at the uni and we had decided we would put on one for the comedy festival. Mm. Again, not like, oh, we're going to do a festival show. It's going to be the biggest thing. Like we just thought it would be fun. And it was going really well. And then about a week, it was probably about 10 days before the festival, is when my dad passed away. And it was very sudden. It was a heart attack while he was driving. Bizarrely, seeing we've mentioned the cello, I was playing in this group at uni. Again, it was just for fun. We'd play like cover songs. It was a guy on guitar. I'd play the cello and another guy would sing. And we were rehearsing in the bottom room of my house. And you could see down the driveway of our house. It was kind of a hill. And I remember seeing like cops walking up the driveway. My first thought was, oh, which neighbor has called the police on a cello and a guitar? Like it really wasn't loud. Like that was my first thought. Like, who are these assholes that have just called the? Yeah. And then I have a thing, and it's kind of what I've always done. If I get anxious, like I'll make a joke to deal with it. I've done it my whole life, and sometimes it works and it bursts attention. Sometimes my partner will tell you it makes things a lot worse in that moment. But I remember that as soon as I like they came to the door of this room at the bottom of our house, I just said to them, I said something like, oh, is it too loud for you? And like the woman didn't laugh at all. Mm. And then she kind of, and it was partly me, it's almost this thing of like, oh, I think I knew she was going to say something bad, like on a like sort of almost primal level. Like, and it was almost like, if you make a joke, you can stop the bad thing coming or something.
Yeah.
And then she kind of went, oh, are you, is this your family? I said, no, it's just two guys that I'm playing with. And I said, my sister's upstairs. And then we went upstairs and they said, your father has passed away. And it's just like, you know, it really, you know, when you watch movies and you get the record scratch moment, like I hate those trailers where it's like, he was going to do this. And then I hate that moment, but it really was like a record scratch moment. Like it was just like, I always describe it as like, it was like an invisible fist punching you in the face or something. It was just like, and it felt like it came at a moment. Like I remember maybe a week before telling him we were going to do this show for the comedy festival. I remember how proud he was. Like, because in a lot of people's mind, the comedy festival is what you see on TV and the gala. And so in his mind, it was kind of like, oh my God. And it was just this moment of like, I remember it so clearly, that moment. And then I remember thinking, well, I just won't do this festival show. And then Mum said to me, I think you should do it because I think that you're going to get too upset if you just hang around the house. You might as well be around your friends and you might as well do something that you love. She had a friend that was a counsellor and the friend, I think, had said that to her. And so I said to the guys, I'll do it as long as – I'll do it and if it gets weird, then I'll stop doing it. Mm-hmm. And that literally became – it was like every night that was – it gave something to aim for each day. It was 3 weeks and the show was on at 7:30 every night and it just gave a thing to go to. And it became – as much as I said to you, I would get anxious in front of crowds performing. In this instance, I wasn't. Like it felt like for an hour and a half each night, it was like this suspended reality where you'd go out on stage, people didn't know this is what had happened to you. You were kind of free or something. It was that was, if you're looking for the kind of transformative moment, that was kind of where for me it went from, comedy went from being a thing I just did for fun to the fun kind of became serious or so, like it kind of became like a,
this is what I do.
Yeah. It was like an escape. Like if you're going to do something after somebody has just died and your life is a bit, my dad had a business and, you know, we hadn't paid off the house. And if you're going to do it, you're only going to do something that you love when it's, if you're in turmoil.
Yeah.
And I think that was where it changed for me. It became a thing where it had just been a bit of fun between friends to, I'm trying not to use this word, but to almost like a survival thing. Like it was like, I felt every time I walked into that theater, I still remember the theater, like, it kind of felt like safe every time you walked in there. And it's interesting. I do think since that moment, like I've never been able to you know, you hear people say, oh, it's just jokes. Or like for me from that moment, it was never just jokes after that. Or when you watch a comedy TV show and I see people and I see something that I think is kind of shallow comedy, I kind of – it never works for me. Like I think some people, that's fine. It's like an escapist thing or – unfortunately or fortunately, what just the reality is it's always had to, for me, comedy has to be mixed in with some kind of darkness or some kind of darker truth. Like it just had to, that's at that formative moment, that's kind of how I felt, yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay. Because I guess you can't be anything but present when you're out on stage, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Trying to make people laugh.
Yeah.
So – yeah, you're in that moment and I guess it helped you to...
That's exactly what it was. And I think partly because it didn't come completely naturally to me to be standing on the stage, I was even more present. Yeah. Like I was sort of like, I was right in the moment. Yeah. And I would get quite deflated after the shows had finished. And then there's a whole, you know, other side to that where you drink too much to afterwards to try and because you got to go home and stuff. But... there was just this turning point. And then one night we finished early or we didn't go out. We finished a show and then we didn't go out and we decided to go to Trades Hall just down the road because that's where a lot of the independent shows would play. And we just picked a random show to go to because we thought, oh, we should watch someone else's show. And there was a show, a lot of people won't know it. If you're a comedy nerd, you will know it, but it was a show called Brian Munich and Friends. I didn't know anything about it except the poster looked insane. The guy was holding a knife to his eyeball and something about that appealed to me. And that's right. That was one of their posters. And then the other image was a puppet that just had knives all stuck in it. Yeah. And something, I don't know, something about it appealed to me. And I said, let's go to this thing. And we went in. I didn't know anything about it. And it was one of the darkest comedy shows I've ever seen. It only had about 8 people in the audience. And it was a very, I can't even, it was kind of like a through the looking glass. This is a terrible cliche, but this one really was a through the looking glass look at Australian culture. Like they at one stage they'd have this spoken word segment and it would be all like Bruce, they had a guy playing Bruce McAvaney and he came out and did a poem in this spoken word thing and it was called Semen of Black. And there was just something about that really, I still remember it. Like it was like, beware the man with the semen of black.
Bruce and McAvaney.
Yeah, it was a guy playing the character, but it sounds crazy, but there was something in that I felt like everything that was normal and suburban and innocent and sort of youthful to me had kind of messed up because of my dad dying. I felt like I saw the world in a much more kind of tilted or the prism had tilted. And I was watching these guys on stage and it was like they had this dark, you know, cracked mirror version of the world. And it's the most I had laughed since my dad died. Like, I mean, it was proper like crying laughter. Like there's whole bits of that show I could quote because it just kind of burned into my brain. And I loved it so much I went back 2 more times and then on the 3rd one I introduced myself to the guy afterwards and his name was – and I said – I didn't explain anything. I just said this show has meant a lot to me. And he said, oh, yeah, I've noticed you in the crowd a few times. And then he said, oh, look, if you ever want to talk about comedy or whatever. And he was so inviting and we became friends. And then it was a remarkable fluke. But I often think when you're doing stuff out of good faith and what you love, a couple of years later he was made the head writer at Rove. I think Rove decided he needed more dark spoken word poetry from Bruce McAvaney in the show. And Jace became the head writer and he said, would you like to write on the show? And that was where it went from, oh, we're just doing shows to our friends to, oh, this is my job and this is my life. And it's just that funny thing. I always say to people, like, if you like something someone did, go up and talk to them afterwards. Like, not for a career thing, but because we all wonder, like, is this good? Is it like you make stuff to connect to people? Yeah. And I don't know if I would have normally gone up to him. I think I just didn't at the time. I didn't really. You kind of, when someone's died, you kind of don't worry about all social etiquette and stuff. And so, I felt like I had to say that I enjoyed the show.
So we'll get to Rove in a minute.
Mm.
So there wasn't any really structured planning.
No, there wasn't. No.
What you were going to do.
Nope.
It just morphed into what you do today.
Yeah, I remember as we started to do those festival shows, I got a notebook from the university, like, news agent, and yeah. I would just start to write on the bus on the way home, like it was just, and or I would start to write in lectures, and it just becomes the thing that you do. Like I wasn't even really thinking. It wasn't like, oh, this will be my career now. I was just doing it. Like you're trying to find your voice, and you're kind of excited that you might have written something funny, or you might have. You just suddenly start to do it, and then it wasn't that. Me meeting Jason and then the Rove job. It was maybe 3 years apart,
right?
Possibly, it was probably maybe about 3.5 years. But what I knew, okay, I think I want to do this, and so much so that I would between like when I had finished uni, I would when I didn't still have a proper job, I would literally go to a cafe. I'd think I need to work on this skill, and I'd just go to a cafe and I would get newspapers and look at whatever was in the news and write kind of ideas and jokes, or I'd go, oh, that seems like an interesting character, or that's what I would do. And you would often get asked by the – also because I wasn't like – I didn't have much money. So you'd just buy coffee and you'd stay in the same cafe for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I remember like a guy saying one day – and he wasn't saying it to kick me out. Like I remember the barista came up and he just goes, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm just trying to write things. And he goes, oh, you sit here looking so serious. And I'd literally buy one coffee for 3 hours. You'd kind of – if you ticked over 3 hours, you might buy a second one. Yeah. And that was kind of it. That was, and I could use their newspapers. I think I'd worked it out that if one coffee was cheaper than me going to buy the three newspapers, and Man. So you, smart. And they'd often, you know, if you were lucky, there was a music magazine there or something. And so, and it also gave, I don't know, some people write very privately and like to be in their house. I like to have things around and I like to overhear people. Like, say, I've just thought about it because of the lockdown about how I need external stimuli. The first cafe I went to after the lockdown was over, I just went and ordered a coffee and I was on my own. And I swear there was two gym guys sitting across from me and I was overhearing them, and I heard one of the guys say to his mate, he goes, the ab crunches that I'm doing now are so strenuous, they are actually activating the exact same muscles with the same tension as a woman who gives birth. And immediately I wrote it down and I realized that was what I was missing. Like you, that kind of,
wow,
that kind of like, and that, like, that guy doesn't know, but now we're saying it now, yeah, you know? Yeah. And so I think some people don't use that external stimuli. They like to be in a quiet room and that's fine. But I think I kind of trained myself during that period, like whatever you can find. I remember sitting in a cafe and a guy, I swear to God, a guy in Northcote went past on a skateboard in a trilby hat playing a ukulele. And there was just something like you go, oh, okay, there might be something in that image. And you might not use it, but it's kind of like a bit of gas that, yeah, you know, you can then, or, you know, that you can then flick a match at or something. Like it's just, I kind of need that. So it was funny. That's, I literally maybe for 2 and a bit years would go to this cafe and would – there was a couple, like I felt like I was overstaying my welcome. I'd go to the other one across the road. One of them went broke and I assume probably because it was just me going in there ordering one coffee. Right. But and you would occasionally just think, am I mad? Like, I'm just writing stuff no one's ever going to read. I would still do it on the radio, but I'd talk about it. But it was kind of didn't feel, I wasn't sure where it was all going. And then I was very, very lucky I got the job at Rove. And I remember we walked in and this is 2007. So it was before everything was on the internet. And the Jason, who was the head writer, walked us in and he said, look, basically it's a very topical show. Here's all the newspapers. And it was a desk about 3 times the size of your desk. And it had every paper from all over Australia on the table. And they just said, just go through these and come up with stuff that you think would be on the show. And I was like, it was this weird thing where everything that I'd been doing kind of trained for that moment.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
Did so, you think, sorry, go.
What does a writer do on a show like Rove? And remind our viewers who,
who Rove was.
Right, our listeners who Rove was. And
at the time, it was the biggest kind of nightly. It was the biggest like night show, weekly night show, late night show in Australia. It was originally on Tuesdays. I wasn't on the Tuesday iteration. I was on the. Then it moved to Sunday nights, and it was. It was. I mean, you know, shows don't rate like that anymore. But it would routinely rate 1.5 million people when you would go. You know, when for each episode. So it was. And for a show like that, we especially when it came back. Because it's Rove's wife passed away, he stopped it for quite a long time, and that's I kind of hate saying this bit, but it is the truth of it. He thought he ended the show. A lot of people that were working on it left, and then maybe 6 or 8 months later, he decided to come back, and people had found jobs, and so they needed this new generation of writers. And I was luckily one of the people that got asked to try out for it and got on. And so yeah, you would, but at that time they decided it was a very topical show. That was when The Chaser was massive, topical humor, and that
it
moves, stuff moves, like maybe yeah. Before that the show was very sketchy, or like I don't mean but like sketch space comedy, yeah. Or there'd been times it had been chatty, they had a lot of stunts in it previously, and I've never really been good at like stunts and that type of thing, so I was just, it was a fluke that when they came back they went, we're going to go really hard topical, it'll be a Sunday night show that summarizes the week's news. And then we'll make it topical. And so I was just lucky, like what I've been doing for 2.5 years kind of kicked in. And so when you say, what do you do? Once I was on the show, they have a whiteboard and it's got 6 segments. And that show had a shape built into it already. You knew there was a monologue at the top of the show. So it would be the 1 or 2 big stories.
Yeah.
Then you knew there would be a chat with him and the cast. Then you knew the first guest would be in the second bracket. Then you, in the third bracket, there might be a sketch. In the fourth bracket, there might be another guest. In the fifth bracket, there might be another comedy sketch. And in the end, we knew that was the end of the show. And so you kind of had to plug things in to fill each yeah. gap. And you literally, from whenever you go in on the Tuesday, you start filling in things, and gradually those 6 segments fill up, and you suggest things and go, maybe we could do we've got a new cast member, maybe let's do a show about their, you know, what hazing rituals did they go through in the office, or you know, there's a big, I'm just trying to think what, you know, so it is more than 10 years ago, but you know, there's a big story that it's an election coming up, you know, where's John Howard been this week or something. So you would literally fill it up, and you would write so much more than what got into the show. I remember the head writer saying to us, if you don't get a joke in, don't worry, because the strike rate on the news jokes was 1 in 8.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And so, because I remember I got a joke in the first episode, and I remember thinking, oh, this is really easy. I don't tell this joke anymore because I got in trouble for telling it at a kid's school when I went to do a writing workshop. But the joke was, and it was based on a true news story, somebody from the government had said they need to teach sex education younger. And so the first joke that I ever got on the show was a politician has today said kids as young as prep should be taught sex education, therefore they will release a children's book entitled Humpty Dumpty Sat on a Cock. And I don't think it's genius. I don't think it's...
Did that go on Rove?
It did. It was in the first episode of 2007.
Yeah.
And I remember Mum like rang straight after the show and I go, Mum, I got a joke in the show. And she goes, oh my God, what was this joke? And I said, the Humpty Dumpty one. And there was just, his mum's quite Catholic. Up, she goes, oh dear. And that, but it was kind of, I do remember in that moment thinking, like I heard that, I could hear through the wall to the backstage area, you could hear the audience laugh. Mm-hmm. And then I remember thinking like, oh my God, there's like 1 million people watching this at home. And I suddenly, people always go, oh, did you mind like someone else doing your jokes? And I was like, not at all. Like I loved the idea that 1 million people just saw that.
Yeah.
And then, but then interestingly, I reckon for the next 4 weeks, I didn't get another joke in the show. And I remember thinking, because I left that night going, this is easy. You just write like rude stuff that you think of and then it gets in. It's interesting, like you go, did that get in the show? I reckon it was one of those ones that was borderline. They probably read it in rehearsal and it got a really big laugh. It was a pretty actual unusual joke to get in the show because we were still in a family time slot. And I think that algorithm actually poisoned my brain because I think I went, oh, I'll just keep writing rude, you know, nursery rhyme based jokes. And I didn't get anything for 4 weeks. And I really did start to think, oh, my God, what if they fire me? Like, what if they don't? What if nothing?
Did you think you'd lost your ability to be funny?
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of like a thing that came naturally to you or you did for no money and then suddenly you're being paid for it and it's being scrutinized. And we had, like, it was quite brutal what would go in the show. Like, they would read it out at the desk and you would get very nervous. And but we actually had, at the time, the head writers, Jason and Ray, were very supportive people, but you still felt like if you didn't get something in, you'd let them down. And so, yeah, you just started to think, like, oh, maybe the spell's broken, or because I've been paid, is it, like, I imagine maybe it's that thing, like, people that love playing cricket or something and then they make the Australian series, like, oh, why doesn't that shot work anymore? And it's probably two things. It's probably the balls are a bit better, like the competition is better, but also it's, you're in your own mind, you're thinking, I've got to try harder, and so what came naturally. And then, thank God, probably the fifth show or something, I got a joke in, and then I got another one, and then I was kind of okay after that. But it was I remember feeling, especially during that 4 weeks, a shocking anxiety. Like,
and has that been, is that a constant? because I was thinking, leading up to talking to you, I was just thinking, shit, the pressure day in, day out. Because, like, it's a job.
Yeah.
And you go to work and you write and you write and you write. Like, just the pressure to be funny the whole time. Is it a constant that you go, I don't know whether I've got this?
Yeah, you go through stages. Like, I felt like that whole first year I had to prove myself. Mm. And then somewhere in the second year, it kind of clicked for me that it sounds ridiculous that it took a year to work it out, but I went, oh, this is my job now. This is my career. And, like, I imagine tradies have to go to work and they've got a sore thumb from hitting their thumb. Like, I imagine, you know, lots of lawyers have to go to work and they're coming down from cocaine. Or the people have to, you know, my sister's a teacher. She has to go and maybe she didn't sleep well the night before. But it's your job. So you have to do it. And I remember reading during that time a Tom Waits quote, and he said, it's like fishing. Some days heaps of fish will bite. You'll go back to the exact same spot and the fish won't bite. But unless you put your line in, you're never going to catch a fish. So you just keep turning up. And I think what the big thing Rove gave me was a discipline that you turn up and you just keep doing it. It's like it built a muscle in my brain or something. And then I could suddenly do it. Like, it was like that muscle was kind of worked over those 3 years. So there was still pressure. Like, if you'd still feel bad if something didn't, you know, if something didn't work or something didn't hit, or you still feel it now. Like, if you do a read, like, now I don't really do those kind of shows anymore. I do narrative shows, but you'll do a read at a table. I remember the show I wrote with Ronnie, international student, the first three episodes we read just – when we had the whole cast, so it was after the whole writing period, first three just burst out of the blocks. And I was like, oh, how easy is this? Because we only got them all for one or 2 days? And the first three, I was like, oh, this is amazing. And then the fourth one, it just wasn't quite right. Like, we had not got it was like a piece of music, the key signature wasn't right. And it just didn't work. And it's not, you can't say, oh, it was a bad audience or the actors, because it had been going so well for three episodes. Something about that wasn't right. We'd missed the mark on it. And the worst bit is you see the actors trying really hard, like willing it to be funnier. Like, you see them kind of, they're trying and you can't do anything while they're reading it. Like, because all you can do is kind of bear it. And you're like literally marking it, you're like, because you'll tick a line if it's good, not out of ego, but just go, okay, we don't have to worry about that. But then if there's a flat spot, you might like put a cross or a question mark or circle it. But you get to the end, but this particular one just crosses the whole way down. We hadn't quite nailed it, so we had to go back and do it, you know, and pretty much rebuild it from scratch.
You write it.
Are you always right about that? You know, sometimes you think, this isn't funny, and then it turns out funny.
Yeah.
This is my experience. I think it's funny, but it's not.
Yeah.
How often did you get that balance right?
No, like you still get it wrong. Like yeah. you still, I think the hardest bit, and that international student would be an example, that like we wrote on that every day for 6 months, either me and Ronnie together. I went over to visit him in the States and we literally wrote every day, or we were on Skype every day. And I think sometimes, especially it's interesting that it was episode 4, because I think you start with all this energy, then that will carry you so far. But there will just be one where something, maybe you haven't got the core joke of it right, or you haven't got the, there's always a seed in the script where you go, I think that that line is kind of the heart of it. And maybe you just, you were tired or you were racing to get over the line, you just took a tangent in some way and it just didn't quite work. Like there's just something, it's kind of like a car. Like it might just be one wire that needs to be fixed, or something needs to be realigned, or at worst maybe you need to strip the whole car down. And I have had that, and you have to rebuild it from scratch because you just, something that was funny, you kind of sent it in the wrong direction or something. A lot of it is instinct. And so that you can still get it totally wrong, and it might be, sometimes you think, I know that will work, and just for some reason that line or that bit doesn't work. You know, it might be like one scene in a thing. Like it's just funny. Like you, for whatever reason, maybe you were off that day, or maybe you both, I don't know. But you kind of make peace with it and go, okay, well, we can at least now work out how to fix it.
Yeah.
Is it clear? Is there a really clear delineation between when the script doesn't work or when an actor can't deliver on your amazing scripts?
Yeah, look, it's often a bit of, you kind of, I remember Billy Wilder, you know, the comedy writer and director, there's this, I've got the book that, who interviews him? It's like, I think it's, is it Cameron Crowe? It's somebody like that. And they basically say, like, the whole book is an interview about how do you write a great movie? And he literally says a bit somewhere at the start, write a great script, get a good cast. And then they're like, oh, but we got to write a whole book. And so he kind of elaborates on that. And I think you want to find someone that there has to be some connection of truth to the character. Like the guy in International Student, the kind of arrogant guy that only Elvin, who only wants A's, who is only there to pass. Like that's based on a guy that Ronnie knew. And there's a touch of Ronnie in that character as well. And we knew we had to find somebody kind of a bit arrogant to play that role. And we all through the auditions, we couldn't find someone who was at that level. Like, and I don't mean level of skill, just like they couldn't hook the truth in. So you start to doubt it and you go, have we got this character wrong, or have we? But then our casting director happened to be at a showcase for like NIDA or Whopper and said, I've found an Asian guy. He's very cocky because he's just got out of acting school and he's very attractive. And he might, and we interviewed him on Skype, and he came on the Skype call looking like the character. He had a kind of cap off to the side, this like shimmering jacket, and kind of was just talking about how good he would be at this. Well, he kind of said, he goes, I get this guy. He's a dick. He's like me hanging around with my friends. Like we're all just massive dicks. And Ronnie just started to nod as this, he walked around behind the screen and was pointing down going, this is the guy, this is the guy. And I think he just had an energy where he got the character. Now that's an example of, it hadn't totally popped in the auditions, but we found the right guy that connected to it. But sometimes it doesn't pop, and it's because you haven't quite found the truth in the character yet. You haven't, the guy that's in International Student, the law professor, Professor Dale, that was in the auditions, it wasn't quite popping because we'd written him as a very big comedic authority character. We wrote him as high status because a lot of law professors are high status. And then the first round of auditions, nobody nailed it. And then the comedian, Anthony Morgan, who was Denton's offsider for years and was one of the biggest stand-ups in the country, who now lives in Tasmania, he put down an audition from home. And he was just filming it off his screen. I'm pretty sure he had the words written on the screen because you're supposed to look off camera when you do it, but he was looking down the barrel. And he did this audition where he read his lines and the other person's lines. And I still to this day don't know if he did it on purpose or kind of just started and then, and it was funny. Like it was properly, hilariously funny. And we suddenly realised in that moment that this professor should be a kind of crazier, lower status character. And what's his lower status? He doesn't want to be at the university anymore. He doesn't care about the esteem. He's kind of been there too long and he's gone a bit mad. And then I said, I go, regardless of whether he meant to read that script like that or not, that's exactly what that character would do. Like, there's something, and we realised that a lot of the actors we were getting in were like awesome actors, like older Australian actors that had done stage, but they were straight guys trying to play crazy, whereas Anthony came in and he played a crazy guy trying to play straight.
Right.
Yeah.
And immediately flipped it around for us. I think the writing was maybe 75% of the way there, but he revealed something about it in that moment and we went, oh, that's the guy. And so then it infests in how you write the rest of the character. And I still remember he came out and had to do the opening scene of his character where his character comes out and goes, good morning, everybody. And Anthony was not a stand-up who used to write scripts and learn them. He would kind of work it out on stage. And so he walked out there and he looked amazing dressed as this mad old professor. And he goes, good morning, everybody. And then he blanked, because you can often see when an actor blanks, you see this kind of look of paranoia in their eyes. Yeah. He had a full lecture theatre of all these students. And he blanked, and I'll never forget, we were looking at the split outside the studio and outside the lecture theatre, and his head just slammed down on the desk. Like, you'll see it if you watch the pilot. His head just goes forward, and because he's got a mic like under his shirt, it made a really loud thump. Like, it just went dunk, and he slammed face first into the desk. And suddenly everybody's like, what's going on? Has he had a stroke or is he? And I remember looking at the director and I was like, just keep rolling. And the director was nodding like he got it straight away. Anthony's head was probably on the desk, and the extras, who were all like 17, 18-year-olds, they didn't know what was going on. And then we kind of hear him muffled on his microphone after about 40 seconds go, can somebody yell cut? And he had just blanked, and the only thing he could think in that moment was to slam his head on the desk. But we realised that's exactly what that character would do. That character, it's not that he's panicked. It's like he can't go through another day of this. Yeah. Like this is another year of teaching these students who aren't listening. And so we got a pickup. When we cut back in, we didn't need him to do his entrance again. We literally started with his head on the table and he lifts it back up. So the shot that you get is he walks out, goes, good morning, everyone. This is in the show. He slams his head on the desk. We needed to find a point to cover it, so where we'd cut. We cut to Ronnie and Asher from a different shot looking confused, like, who is this guy? And then he lifts his head back up and goes, and welcome to your first day of law school. And that is a million times better than what we wrote. It's like, and so he caught a little truth in what he discovered, something in our thing. He did something. We discovered something through what he did. That, to me, is your best relationship. It's nobody's forcing their will onto it. You kind of, you know, somebody said to me, characters don't really change, they reveal. And I think that that's what a really good performer will do. They'll kind of find this other gear or this thing that's there. They don't invent it. The problem is when they invent it out of thin air, like, then there's no truth. Whereas for Anthony, you know, he had been a stand-up that had done it for 20 years. He'd stood up in front of pubs and hadn't wanted to perform on certain nights, and he had seen highs and lows. And I think he kind of found a connection to this. I remember he said to me after that, he goes, oh, no, this bloke. And that was all. And then suddenly that makes you write with this supreme confidence, because you know that they've got it. And even if you miss it, they'll kind of find something in it. And then they're the best relationships, when you get a moment and you get a kind of character or a scene like that.
Yeah.
Super cool. Hey, I reckon we could talk to you for probably 3 days.
Yeah, I've kept banging on. Sorry.
No, not at all. But I've got a couple more questions before we'll have to blow time. You've got an amazing body of work that, you know, just the sheer volume of stuff that you've written. Like, we've been podcasting for 5 minutes in comparison to you. I think you brought out The Sweetest Plum back in 2010.
Mm-hmm. I always say it's a bit facetious, but we did it like before everyone podcasted. And I, the joke that I used to say was, we were the Velvet Underground of podcasts. Like, nobody listened to us, but anyone that did went and started their own podcast.
Yeah.
We just, none of us have ended up with a massive heroin addiction yet. But it could, you never know. You never know.
Yeah, maybe it could. But I did read that, you know, you were right up top of the charts for a, you know, for a long time. But for, so you've been banging out, you bought, banged out 196 episodes over 10 years for mm-hmm. the Sweetest Plum. And recently, tell us about Crossbred
mm-hmm.
and should I say the award-winning Crossbred?
Has it won an award? Well, it was award nominated. We got nominated for ARIA and we didn't win, but we were beaten by Anne Edmonds, who I think is the funniest. I genuinely think she's possibly the funniest person in the country. So I was extremely pleased. I was very happy for her to win that. And yeah, we got named by the, I suppose you could call it an award. Apple Podcast releases their favorites of the, yeah, you don't physically get an award. What they send you is a little JPEG and it says one of our favorites and then a picture of your graphic. So that's technically an award,
that
isn't
is
it?
For yeah. sure. Like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Well, my son brings home those, you know.
Oh, little, yeah. It's like a participation award thing.
Yeah. Blow it up, put it on the wall. How many people have listened to Crossbred?
That's a very good question. I don't know, but it's partly the way that the ABC put it up through their server and then when it spits out to iTunes and to the international servers and then the ABC's site, they have to kind of correlate it all together. The last time I checked, and that this is including overseas audiences, it was up around 200,000.
Yeah, wow.
And that, but I'm very pleased with that because it is, it's my, at the moment, probably because it's the last thing I made, it's my favourite thing that I've ever made. And that's not a knock on international student. It's just that I wrote that 5 years ago and it was a very particular time in my life. And that was probably my favourite thing I did then. But Crossbred was also international student was Ronnie's story. I was just trying to help him build a world around it. Yeah. Whereas Crossbred really was, it's for people that don't know what it is, it's about a Christian hip hop group based in the outer suburbs of Melbourne in Boronia. They're not initially Christian. They're kind of faking it because they get paid for the gig and then they kind of blow up as Christian hip-hop superstars. And then what happens after that? That I know we're running over time, but I've got 6 minutes to describe the inception of it.
Sure.
So I wanted to, Chris, who's the rapper in it, the main guy, Josh, and who wrote it with me along with Megan Washington, we went to high school together. He didn't like hip-hop music. That was me. He liked Pink Floyd and things like that. But I remember saying to him, Chris is an opera singer by trade, and I like kind of insular worlds, like weird little worlds, and like international student, or I just like kind of rules that have their own world that are away from everything. And I just happened to say to him when ABC were doing these podcasts, because I thought, oh, something musical, opera is very distinct maybe. And then I said, I've just got this idea about siblings that blow up, because I've got a sister and the kind of interesting dynamics that happen between. And I said, I just got this idea about two siblings that blow up, and like maybe they're opera singers, but they blow up like on the main charts. And then he said, I really love this. I love that you've suggested it. And he goes, can I just change one thing? And I go, yeah. And he said, I've been an opera singer for over 10 years. And nobody gives a fuck about opera singers. And he goes, in fact, it's a way to get people to walk away from you at a party if you mention you're an opera singer. And he goes, could it be something else that they sing? And he said, is there something else, like some other type of music? And so we were just kind of spitballing it. And what came up was we had both been in Christian youth groups at school and we were remembering the bands that used to come to the Christian youth camps, and we were just kind of talking about that, and we started to think, because especially when we were growing up, they were kind of these bands like refashioned themselves as like kind of indie grunge, like Christian bands.
Yeah,
like they
do.
Like this would be their Pearl Jam song about, you know, God. Or I remember one, they would do like, I remember one distinctly, they ripped off Four Non Blondes, like, you know, remember and the woman's like, I love you, God, like seriously, like that's not a joke. And so we started to laugh about that, and then we were like, but what is it now? Like, surely they don't do that now. And we went to incognito to one of these churches, what do you call them, like new Pentecostal churches. Just to kind of see what the music was, you get met at the door and they're like, oh, two new people. It's kind of like they literally sense like, oh, it's fresh meat. Yeah. And so they walk you to your seat and they're like, if you want to stay around and have a coffee. And the band came out And it was very kind of like high energy, and there was a guy and that had break dancers, and then there was a woman singing and a guy came out and rapped, and we just went, oh, that's what it is. It's going to be this hip-hop group. Dog. And we kind of knew in that moment. Like, and then Chris was like, because I kind of wanted to be a rapper when I was a kid, and so you write things that you didn't get to do.
We missed that part.
Oh, right. But Chris just said that, he goes, there's just a slight problem, I haven't rapped. And I was like, it's fine, that'll make it even better. And then I just said to him, if we're going to do this, like, it's actually got to be good. When you make your music parody shit, the shitness, the joke runs out after one song. And I was like, if we do this, the tricky bit here is we have to believe they blow up. Like, they can't be awful. And so you have to hit, and that was the thing we noticed at this church we went to. They were actually good musicians, but just funneling it into this thing. And so I just said to him, the other person that's in this is going to have to be a gun musician and funny. And he said, what about Megan Washington? I did a show in the Fringe with her, and he said she was just meant to do the music, but she was so funny, we put her into the show as a character. And I never met her before, and he said, let's meet her next time she's in Melbourne. And we met her, and it turns out she was also a Christian youth group kid.
Get
in
out.
The first like few minutes, she said she was a Christian youth group kid. Because she could sing, they would send her to be the recruiter and like to try and like get kids excited, and she was kind of singing for God. And as I had said to Chris, because you never want to offer someone a job until you've got, and I'd said, just don't offer it to her, just please, let's meet her, let's see. And like, I was literally left meeting them and sent him a message going, just ask her now. Yeah. It has to be this person. This, I know, I just know she's been sent to us by God. And she just instantly got it. And then her and Chris, that, and because she's such a good musician, like we would take her our dumb ideas and go, could you sing this? And she made it, you know, she made it amazing. And she did.
Mate, for the people listening to this podcast, we don't have quite 200,000, but have a listen, because it's bloody hilarious. But you're right. It's believable, the quality of music and the quality of songs. Like, I was thinking at the time, shit, you could nearly release some of this stuff, because there's got to be a big audience out there for, you know.
It was reviewed by a woman on the BBC. There's a show called the BBC Podcast Hour.
Yeah.
And she reviewed it and then sent it, or she was going to review it. She sent it to a co-host, and he turned up to the studio, because she just sent it to him as a file and not as the actual, like, here's the link to the podcast. He thought it was real. And so they got in there, and he said, I've only just realized as you were talking that this is a parody. I've only listened to the first episode. Likewise, my friend Madeline Parry, who directed Nanette, Hannah Gadsby special, she is a documentary maker by trade. She listened to one episode and she goes, she said, how did you find these? She sent me a message going, where did you find this hip hop group? This is amazing. How did I not know this story? And I wrote back to it, can you keep listening? It's fiction. And so we would often ABC, because people before that, when they get annoyed and listen to things, ABC were getting so many messages going, why are you playing Christian propaganda on my station? And why are you, people didn't twig. Like, they, once you get to the second episode, you then twig once they get inside the church. But that the song that there was a huge pressure on that song, the one that we got nominated for ARIA, you had to believe that that song was good enough that it would blow up online, and you had to believe that it would, but it had to be funny. And we wrote, my God, about 20 versions of that song, and we did a read of it for people at ABC on the Friday before we were going to record on the Monday. Like what you were saying, that the thing burst out of the blocks. I was reading Aaron's part because Aaron was away, and I was standing there going, oh my God, this is going so well. And it got to that song and it just died. You know it's not working, because they've been laughing at everything. They've been laughing at just narrations.
Yeah.
And I just got this wild wave of panic going, the whole thing hinges on, does that song work? And I rang Megan and I said, it's not you. It's like, she just wrote the music. Like, we all kind of came out, and I said, something's not working. And so we kept trying to rewrite it. And then we rewrote it on the roof of the ABC on the day that we recorded it. And we kind of worked out like this idea of what would happen if G, like, we're trying to find the core joke. And the joke was, what would happen if Jesus walked into Forest Hill Food Court? Like, that was literally after all this high kind of – all this high concepts, like, how do these people, like, write this song and how, what would happen if you put Jesus into abject suburbia and into the food court? And it just clicked. Like, we literally wrote it and – it just, it tumbled out. It was one of those moments. And we just went, let's just go downstairs. And it, but that's one of those ones. You do not know because it's happened so fresh. You're thinking that it's working, but at the same time, you're going, are we all, have we gone mad? Like, is this, you know, it like, the song is ludicrous, but you just have to kind of back your instinct on it. And to me, the whole thing hinged on it. And I still remember we recorded it and then Megan said, she'd done all the music for it, and she said, I still reckon if it's going to be the song that blows up, the production level has to be like it's a hit single. Yeah. So we sent it to her producer and said, could you remix it, mainly just to make some of the instruments pop and to put vocal effects on it so it sounded live, but it needs to have proper scratching on it. And it came back the day before we were going to upload it. I never met this guy. His name's Mario Spate. I never met him, and I was terrified. What if it's wrong? We don't have any time to change it. It turned up as a text message, as a link to a Dropbox thing, and I said to my partner, it was during the lockdown, I'm just going to go for a walk, and I just need to hear this. And it started, and it got to the bit where Megan's voice distorts and goes to, like, a vocoder and, like, the Kanye West thing.
Yeah.
And I literally just burst into tears because it was better than anything I could have imagined in my mind. And then I started to laugh. And there was a guy just two streets from our house in his front yard, like a kind of guy watering, and he didn't know what to do with this crazy person crying and laughing. I've seen him look at me since, and he's like, what is – and I just – that was that moment where I just went, I don't actually care now if this – I never laugh at my own stuff, but I was like, I don't care. If this doesn't work, that is better than when we had this idea than I could have ever imagined it to be, and I don't care. Like, it was this amazing, freeing thing. Like, of course you want heaps of people to listen to it, but I just kind of made peace with it in that moment. And, there's a lot of truth, and it's our lives, and we were kids that grew up in those things, and – yeah, there's a lot of truth in it and a lot of our lives in it. So that's crossbred.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful piece of art.
Thank you.
Piece of work. And for the Doolanders listening to us, jump on, have a listen to Crossbred. Hey, Declan, you've been so bloody generous with your time, mate. One last question. What are you going to do next?
We are hoping to turn Crossbred into a TV show. We've kind of written an idea for how it would be a TV show. It's amazing. Even with having the audio podcast of it, it's amazing how much convincing some people need. Mm-hmm. I think kind of the elements of it spook people. It's Christianity. It's got hip hop. Like, there's kind of things that spook people. That would be the dream. Like, I can see it in my mind. It would be different to the radio. Like, you can't, to the podcast, you can't have, not in a million years would we be able to film them in front of 30,000 people at Mount Panorama at a death metal concert. My mind that shot's like $300,000. Like, it's just not going to happen. But there's ways that you could tell it. So that, it would be that. And I don't know. I will, similar to Crossbred, I'll just wait till the next kind of idea pops up, and then I'll scribble that down and then maybe do that next.
We can't wait to see what you do next. Declan Fay, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Declan.
Thanks, mate.
Hey, Elke, how are you?
Good.
What did you think of Declan Fay?
He's the funniest person I've ever saw in my life.
In your whole life?
Yeah.
Even funnier than your dad?
Yeah.
What? I can't believe that. I mean, your dad's funny, but you're right. Declan was so much funnier, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, you've got something special for us, haven't you?
Yeah.
What is it?
The Doolanders' new theme song.
And who's going to be singing the Doolanders' new theme song?
Me.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Doolanders, Doolanders. What about I do that again, but with Doolanders?
Hey, Doolanders, if you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...